This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
This is the bubble du jour. Right now, Wall Street is pumping up the value of these fracking companies, and they're heavily leveraged, and the dam is about to burst.
We've spoken to Richard Heinberg in the past about several problems inherent to our carbon-based economy, from peak oil to coal to what he's dubbed the end of growth. Now, the author and senior fellow at the Post Carbon Institute has a new book focusing on the natural gas industry's practice of hydraulic fracturing, better known as fracking. Today on Sea Change Radio, we talk about the book titled Snake Oil: How Fracking's False Promise of Plenty Imperils Our Future, and delve into the economic and environmental factors behind the natural gas boom, which to some is an important bridge fuel, and to others is fool's gold. I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by Richard Heinberg. He's a senior fellow at the Post Carbon Institute and an author of several books. His latest is Snake Oil: How Fracking's False Promise of Plenty Imperils Our Future. Richard, welcome back to Sea Change Radio.
Good to be with you, Alex.
So give us a quick overview of Snake Oil. Is this a collection of some of your thoughts, or is this more of the evolution of some of your research analyzing the fracking industry?
The book is a short overview of both the economics and environmental impacts of fracking, and also its meaning in terms of our energy conversation, particularly in the U.S. And that's really what the title Snake Oil is about. The snake oil is the promise of abundance that the oil and gas industry is using to sell not just its products, but energy policy, and an energy policy of all of the above. We're basically being told that as a result of fracking, we have 100 years of natural gas. The U.S. is becoming energy independent. We'll be producing more oil than Saudi Arabia. Maybe we'll even be exporting oil to the rest of the world. So on one side of the equation, we have this picture of abundance and the potential for wealth. And on the other side of the equation, we have the arguments about the environment and climate change and how we need to get off of fossil fuels in order to avert climate catastrophe. Well, you can see how this is very carefully engineered, because most people, you know, are going to look at this choice and say, well, yeah, we do want to preserve the climate, but gee, you know, we want all those jobs and we want the U.S. to be energy independent. And for the moment, that really takes priority. But the point of the book is that it's a false choice. This is the snake oil that we're being sold. In fact, the promises that are being made for shale gas and tight oil are exaggerated. And I say that on the basis of the most thorough and complete analysis of the economics of fracking that's been undertaken to this point. The data do not support either the notion that the U.S. has 100 years of natural gas. More likely, shale gas production will be declining before 2020. That's only 7 years from now. Nor do the data support the assertion that the U.S. can outproduce Saudi Arabia when it comes to oil. Production from the Bakken in North Dakota, the Bakken tight oil play, and the Eagle Ford tight oil play in South Texas will likewise peak and start to decline before 2020. That's on the basis of the data that we have collected and analyzed.
I'm always pretty skeptical whenever I hear that 100-year number thrown around. It seems to be kind of the magic line when it comes to our resources. Oh, we have 100 years of coal. We have 100 years of water. We have 100 years.
Yeah, right.
Basically, they just throw out 100 years, and that's kind of should placate everybody and realize that we need to just not worry about these things.
Right. Well, what the industry has done is to take the best results from the core areas. Each of these plays, whether it's the Marcellus in Pennsylvania or the Barnett in Texas around the area of Fort Worth, each of these geologic plays has a core area, usually the size of a few counties, that is highly productive and profitable to drill. So what the industry has done is taken the initial early results from these core areas and extrapolated them as if the same results can be achieved throughout these enormous geographic regions. With the Marcellus, for example, we're talking about just about all of Pennsylvania, New York State, and West Virginia. If that entire area were as productive as the small sweet spots in the Marcellus, then yes, the industry could produce enormous amounts of gas at low prices, and it would change the energy picture dramatically. But it's simply not true. If you get outside the core areas, the initial production rates from each well drop off, and the decline rates, the rate in which the production declines over time, advances dramatically. So again, if you run the numbers and do it dispassionately, the numbers just don't support this picture of abundance. And it, in fact, the U.S. has earned a very short reprieve, and it's a very costly reprieve, because shale gas and tight oil carry not only the requirement for much higher financial investment, and that's why all these companies that are specializing it, like Chesapeake, Devon, XTO, Range Resources, and on, several dozen of them, they all are deeply buried in debt. They have to take on so much debt in order to finance the high per well costs of fracking. And then they also imply much higher environmental risk than conventional oil and gas production. And that's a whole separate chapter in the book.
And I do want to dive into the environmental risk, but let's stick to the economics for now. When we're talking about comparing the Saudi oil wells to the recent findings in North American natural gas, it's really apples to oranges. When you're talking about a potential of these findings, like Marcellus or Bakken, peaking by 2020. Compare that, if you will, for our listeners, the Saudi experience over the last 100 years.
As you say, these are entirely different kinds of resources. Most of Saudi production comes from conventional oil fields. The oil fields in North Dakota and South Texas that are being produced now with hydrofracturing are unconventional plays, in that the rock has low permeability and low porosity. The stuff is there, but it just doesn't want to move. That's why the rock has to be fractured in order to get at the oil or the natural gas. But that entails much higher costs. The hydrofracturing involves pumping millions of gallons, usually 3-4 million gallons of water with all sorts of chemicals, which of course are trade secrets, slickening agents, propants to keep the pores open once you've fractured them. It takes something like 2,000 tractor trailer truck trips, 18-wheel truck trips per well, carrying water and chemicals and the drilling rig. So the costs per well are very high. And then the initial production rates of these wells, you know, you're talking about Saudi Arabia. They're the biggest oil field, Ghawar, which was discovered in the 1950s, produces close to 5 million barrels per day. Now, you're lucky if one of these hydrofract wells produces 700 barrels per day in its initial production rate, and it drops rapidly after that. So the rate of drilling is very high.
And the rate of water usage as well, right? Like Ghawar now is there's a lot of talk that it's peaked because there's more and more water that needs to be injected to try to get that oil out of Ghawar, which was just one of the richest veins of fossil fuel that man's ever been able to tap into.
That's right.
But this is very different when you're talking about a 7-8 year window now for the Pennsylvania hydrofracturing experience, right? The amount of water and chemicals and energy used to produce X amount of
of natural gas is very different ratio in many respects, right? This is peaking so quickly. That's why it's so important for people to not be comparing this to Saudi Arabia.
Right, and we're talking about the need for thousands of wells. Now, this is happening, remember, mostly in Texas, Oklahoma, and Colorado, as well as Pennsylvania, West Virginia, and North Dakota. In Texas, water, of course, is a very scarce resource. And so much is being used in hydrofracturing that water is being denied to farmers. Even cities are finding their water requirements are bumping up against resource limits. And yet, if the industry is going to produce anything like the amount of natural gas and oil that it's promising, they will have to drill. Already they've drilled something like 65,000 wells. They'll have to drill literally hundreds of thousands more wells, each one requiring millions of gallons of water. This is an environmental catastrophe in so many ways. It's easy to lose count.
Well, let's keep tally here for a second. There's also been quite a lot of controversy surrounding trying to put a finger on the amount of methane that gets produced by the hydrofracturing process. Which side of the fence do you fall? There's a controversial Cornell professor, I forget his name, but he was very anti-methane. What's his name?
Bob Howarth. Tony Ingraffia, also at Cornell. Both of them have made the claim that the amount of methane released in hydrofracturing is high enough that it actually offsets or more than offsets any climate advantage from switching from coal to natural gas. This has been a very controversial claim because, of course, not only the industry, but many of the big environmental groups that want to substitute natural gas for coal are claiming that the evidence just isn't there to support that claim, that in fact, natural gas is much better for the environment, and so basically shut up. But the evidence continues to pile up in favor of Howarth and Ingraffia's claim. Just this week, there was a study released based on data from the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. They did actual direct measurements using aircraft of the methane leaking from fracked gas wells in Utah, and they found between 6% and 12% of the produced gas was actually leaking into the atmosphere. Now, anything above about 3% leakage in production makes coal actually better for the climate than natural gas, and they're talking about 6% to 12% leakage. So, this is a very bad result for in terms of those who want to substitute fracking gas for coal.
So you believe that the Cornell studies of Howarth and Ingraffia are closer to the truth than some of the peer-reviewed findings from ExxonMobil's research arm that has said that there's a relatively low lifetime greenhouse gas emissions coming from shale gas?
Right. Howarth's initial study was flawed, but his findings actually end up being pretty close to accurate based on subsequent data that is more reliable.
Oh, ask them for water. Oh, she brought me gasoline.
Follow the shift to sustainability with Sea Change Radio on Twitter at twitter.com/seachangeradio and on our Facebook page.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking to author Richard Heinberg. His latest book is Snake Oil, How Fracking's False Promise of Plenty Imperils Our Future. One of the heroes of the anti-fracking movement has been Josh Fox and his movies Gasland and Gasland 2. I'm sure you're familiar with some of the criticisms against the movie. Can you maybe address some of the more controversial things that Fox throws out in the film and how you would maybe parry those criticisms?
Well, the basic claim that Josh Fox is making is that fracking is more dangerous to the environment than conventional oil and gas production, in that it is more likely to produce damage to aquifers, to drinking water, to air quality, and therefore to human health, the health of livestock and pets, and also wildlife. Now, of course, the industry counters this and says that there have been no documented instances of harm to the environment or human health as a result of fracking. Well, that's absurd. There have been quite a number of documented instances, but there would be far more of them if it weren't for the industry practice of settling with landowners who have these problems and writing into the settlement a non-disclosure clause so that people who find that their health is suffering, they have to go to the hospital, or the value of their land has plummeted because the water has gone bad. Well, the industry writes them a check, let's say for $1 million, and you know who can refuse that, especially if you're having health problems or if your personal finances are in a shamble because of your land isn't suddenly valueless and you have to move and you can't sell it and so on. So they have to take the check. But in order to take the check, they have to sign the non-disclosure agreement, which means that the rest of the world will never find out about this particular instance of human health damage or environmental damage. This is common. This has been, we don't know exactly how many times this has happened, but certainly, there are anecdotal anecdotal evidence to suggest that this has happened dozens, if not hundreds, of times already.
Now, you've also written about the fight to eradicate coal from the U.S. power grid, correct?
Yes, I wrote a book on global coal called Blackout,
and a lot of people who are now looking at the natural gas boom would agree with you that we need to get rid of coal, but they view natural gas as being largely responsible for the decline in coal use over the last decade. Do you agree with that assertion? And is this just the lesser of two evils, or do you think that natural gas can be an effective bridge fuel to renewables?
Yeah, realistically, I don't see natural gas as being an effective bridge fuel. Yes, it's true, U.S. has reduced its coal consumption in the last few years, mostly because we've had cheaper natural gas, and we've had cheaper natural gas as a result of a temporary glut in supply due to fracking. Now, this brings up all sorts of questions. Can we rely on a future of abundant and cheap natural gas to serve as a bridge fuel? Well, our research says no. Currently, natural gas prices are below the actual cost of production in most instances. The companies like Chesapeake, Devon, XTO, Range, and so on had to buy leases to millions of acres at the very beginning of this boom, but the conditions of those leases said that those acres had to be drilled in order for the lease to be maintained. So the industry has had to drill at a faster pace than it ordinarily would, which has lowered prices of natural gas below the price of coal. So the U.S. switches from coal to gas. But this is an unsustainable situation because these companies are losing money hand over fist. Rex Tillerson, the CEO of ExxonMobil, said, "We're losing our shirts on natural gas these days. Nobody can make money on it because the price is too low." Well, if the price of natural gas goes high enough to make it profitable to the industry, then it's higher than the cost of coal. So one way or another, probably because of natural gas exports, which are in the works right now, one way or another, the price of natural gas is going to go back up over the next few years. So this is not a sustainable situation. Then you bring in the question of methane releases that we were talking about earlier. So if you look at all of the problems with natural gas, especially for North America, and including the fact that regular conventional natural gas in the U.S. is declining rapidly, it all stacks up pretty much against the idea of natural gas serving as a bridge fuel away from coal and toward renewables. We're going to have to go straight to renewables.
So you had just mentioned how Rex Tillerson, ExxonMobil's chairman, had said that they're getting their shirts handed to them on natural gas because the price is so low. What should the oil companies be doing? Are they getting out of this business, or are they just going to keep fracking and then hope for the market to rise?
You know, the particularly the big companies like Shell and Exxon have gotten into this late on in the game, and they had to buy leases in some of the non-core areas. And the only companies that are making money are the smaller companies that bought leases in the core areas. And those are getting drilled out. So this is going to be a short-term boom. You know, we've had financial bubbles in the last few years, like the dot-com bubble and the real estate bubble. Well, this is the bubble du jour. Right now, Wall Street is pumping up the value of these fracking companies, and they're heavily leveraged, and the dam is about to burst.
To listen to Sea Change Radio anytime, anyplace, just subscribe to our free podcast. Simply follow the link from seachangeradio.com or search for us in the iTunes podcast directory.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking to author Richard Heinberg. Is it purely the extraction process which is dirty, or is the burning of it and incorporating it into our grid, is that process also tainted?
If it's just a comparison of coal versus natural gas at the point of combustion, there's no question natural gas is better. Fewer, not only carbon emissions, CO2, but also fewer particulate emissions and all the rest. But it's not so simple. You have to look at the whole supply chain. And of course, for coal, it's horrendous too, especially if you're talking about mountaintop removal coal mining. But then on the other side of the equation, look at what's happening with natural gas. Regular conventional natural gas production, some problems there, but less and less of our natural gas is coming from conventional gas wells, and more of it is coming from hydrofracturing. And there we see problems with not only access to water, but also problems with contamination of water. There was a study by EPA field workers that was cited in Los Angeles Times last week, showing much higher levels of contaminants in drinking water the closer you got to the fracking fields, which clearly suggested that, you know, fracking pollutes water. But the higher ups at the EPA killed that study because the official position of the EPA is that natural gas is better than coal, therefore fracking gas is better than coal, therefore we should not talk about environmental problems of fracking. The U.S. wants to improve its environmental footprint in terms of carbon emissions for the sake of future climate negotiations. And the only way it seems we can do that is with more natural gas. So we're willing to overlook the problems to water, air, human health, animals, livestock, all the rest as a result of fracking. Well, you can refuse to talk about them, but that doesn't make them go away.
Let's look at the pricing. You had mentioned how it's depressed from this glut. Just over the last 5 years, natural gas has gone from around $13 per BT for a million of BTUs down to around in the $3 to $4 range.
That's right.
If we were back at that $13 level, would there still be this fracking boom, or is there an unquenchable thirst for this fossil fuel right now, regardless of price?
Well, we only have fracking because the price of natural gas went up to $13, $14 a thousand cubic feet or a million BTUs a few years ago. See, gas was at much lower prices, around $2 a million BTUs back in the 1990s. But conventional natural gas was depleting and production levels were going down. So the price skyrocketed. And when the price went high enough, the industry brushed off some sophisticated technology and applied it to lower grade resources, the shale formations in Texas and Arkansas and Oklahoma. And that's what resulted in the fracking boom. But in doing that, they produced so much so fast that it drove the price down below the actual cost of production. And right now, the price of natural gas is about $3.25, something like that, per million BTUs. Well, the price in Japan is more like, I think, $17. The price in Europe is that they're paying mostly to Russia is more like $11, $12 a million BTUs. So, of course, the industry desperately needs the price to increase so that they can at least break even. The way they're planning to do that is to export natural gas in liquefied form, LNG, liquefied natural gas, export that to Asia and also to Europe.
It's very different than oil in terms of it's not a commodity with a globally set price.
That's right. This is something people don't understand. The big oil companies are profitable, but they're a sunset industry. The total oil production of the 10 majors, the Chevrons and Shells and BPs and Exxons, production has declined by 25% in the last decade. They are investing twice as much in exploration and production, and they're drilling twice as many wells, and they're producing 25% less product.
That's why we need to subsidize them, right?
Yeah, they're heavily leveraged. They've taken on a lot more debt in order to maintain operations. So yes, they are profitable, but they are, in real economic terms, they're losing ground. And people wonder why, if suddenly we have all of this tight oil from North Dakota and South Texas, why the price of gasoline in the U.S. is still so stubbornly high. Well, it's because oil is a globally traded commodity, so it really doesn't matter how much we produce domestically. If the global supply is tight, then oil prices are going to remain high no matter what we do in North Dakota.
He's the author of Snake Oil, How Fracking's False Promise of Plenty Imperils Our Future. He's also a senior fellow at the Post Carbon Institute. People can go to postcarbon.org to read more of his writing and his colleagues. Richard Heinberg. Richard, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
It's a pleasure, Alex. Thanks.
Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Sanford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise. Additional music by Tony Rice, Alan Wolf, and Steely Dan. Check out our website at seachangeradio.com. That's seachangeradio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For SeaChange Radio, I'm Alex Wise.